Lily is coming later, and she will be cooking for everyone. Almost crossly taking the presents from me, she shoves them under the tree. Presents embarrass her. She doesn't know what to say. She likes giving instead. We have tea at the kitchen table. Her hands rest on the tabby coat of the little cat in her lap.
Haven't seen any fairy lights in your window. Where's your tree, then?
I didn't think to get a tree, I say. I got as far as presents and food. That was enough. Mary shakes her head.
Your kids will want a tree.
Kids? Mary, they're grown up.
Dan's coming by later. He'll find you a tree. He can drop it in.
I don't mind Mary winning. I don't agree with her, but that doesn't matter. As I leave, I give her a kiss, and she scowls. Ed and Sophie are in the kitchen eating breakfast.
Wonderful charcoal, Sophie, thank you.
She looks pleased.
My friend on the next door boat uses an oil drum to make charcoal. He gets this slow fire burning, and it takes about 2 days. The special willow you can get from Somerset. It's just the kind I like, really dark and smooth on the paper.
I run warm water to wash up, squirt in the washing up liquid, and start to collect the plates from the table. Ed hands me his empty mug of coffee. His eyes are unsmiling.
So, art's still the most important thing in your life, Mum?
What?
I turn to him as I slip the crummy plates in the soapy water, wondering if this is a joke. He looks at Sophie as he speaks. There is no laughter in his face.
When Mum went up to paint, we knew not to disturb her no matter what. Isn't that right, Mum?
I feel winded with surprise.
You know that's not true.
Come on.
He leans against the table, arms tightly folded. His voice is hostile. He sounds very sure of his ground.
It was the same when you went to work. You never answered your mobile when I phoned, never there when we got back from school. You used to drive us bonkers.
He turns to Sophie again, gesturing, pretending to be amused.
No decent food, of course.
Why is he doing this?
I know I used to paint, but it was mostly when you were at school. Christ!
Ed interrupts loudly.
Can't you even remember that you weren't around? Whenever I was ill, you left a box of pills by my bed and buggered off to work.
I let you sleep.
Classic. What about the day you told us about the cottage? You said we could have it, then you changed your mind.
It's only that I didn't want it used for parties.
You used to disappear to your studio without warning, he says. No wonder we felt rejected.
When I went upstairs to paint, I had been trying to find my own space, not rejecting the children. How could he even think that?
Ed, art was never, ever the most important thing.
Sophie glances from Ed to me and back again. She tucks a stray lock of red hair behind her ear and looks down at her hands, twisting the little Christmas card I had given her.
Course it was, Ed continues, still staring at me. It was because you could make your pictures into what you wanted.
He wasn't like this last night. What can you mean?
You painted the pictures. You were in charge. Nice two-dimensional art. Not like us, though you tried your best. You thought you were in charge of us as well. You gave us rules. Millions of them.
He is breathing hard and his eyes are bright with anger. I don't know where all this has come from, Ed. It's Christmas Eve.
It hasn't come from anywhere. It's what I've thought all along. Being here again has brought it all back.
I didn't know. I put a hand out to touch his sleeve and he jerks his arm away.
How could you possibly know? You never asked me. You were never there. You probably imagined I was the same as Theo.
He laughs.
Well, perhaps not as perfect Theo, but basically twins think alike, don't they?
Of course not. I know you are completely different.
You have no idea about me any more than you had any idea about Naomi.
His words are coming quickly.
No wonder she's not here now.
Ed stops abruptly, as if he knows he's gone too far. He makes a small movement towards me and then turns towards Sophie.
Come on, Soph, let's go for a walk.
He takes her hand and pulls her to her feet. She lets him lead her out of the kitchen, but turns at the door to give me a brief, unhappy glance. My hands sting with drying washing up liquid, and I put them back into the bowl. The hot water covers them, and I stare down at the bubbles that cluster on my fingers by my rings. It occurs to me that I shouldn't still be wearing them. Silence folds itself back round me, but his words are still inside it. My fingertips are wrinkled by the time I remember there is food to get from the farm shop in Modbury, the next-door village. I dry my hands, tugging at the rings, but my fingers have swollen in the water, and I have to leave them. I lift Bertie into the car and drive slowly, keeping my mind empty. Snow has blown into the hedges, and the hills are dusted white. Not many people are in the shop. The heaps of vegetables and fruit in the old stone building look like a 16th-century Dutch painting. A brace of hanging pheasants drip blood from their beaks, their soft necks are twisted, and the jewel-bright colours of the male's head shine against the soft brown feathers of the female. Dark green sprouts, creamy little potatoes, and shiny clementines spill out of the wooden boxes, and there are dates in a sack by the wall. I buy bags of everything, and pick up eggs, bacon, and a frosted Christmas cake, and load them into the car. On the way home, I stop at the sea, get out and breathe in the bitterly cold salt air. In the open, the silence in my head begins to throb with the words Ed had flung at me. Millions of rules, he had said. Is that how it seemed? But surely he knows rules keep you safe. Bertie and I walk along the snowy turf behind the shingle. Our feet leave translucent prints in the thin layer of icy snow. The grass under mine is twisted and yellow. In the distance, near the white edge of the surf, a young girl is playing with a dog. I can see her fair hair from here. A man stands nearby, hunched into a black coat. I wait until I can see her move before I carry on walking. She runs with her legs kicking out slightly. Naomi's run was arrow-like. If there had been more rules, or fewer, would she still be here? If there had been more, then she might have been safer. If there had been fewer, she might not have had to break them. But it wasn't just the rules. Ed was right. I hadn't been there enough. Naomi didn't talk to me in the weeks before she disappeared, but if I'd been there, ready for the moment, she just might have done. If I had focused on all the little changes, instead of pushing them to the back of my mind, I could have helped her. I told Ted the children didn't want me around. Had I lied to myself in order to construct the life I wanted? Snow begins to fall again, thin, cold flakes that lie separately on the ground. Alcohol hadn't fitted with the schoolgirl who worked hard, so I'd pushed that to the back of my mind and believed her excuses. I even made them for her, so I didn't see the real Naomi, the girl who wore thick makeup and a thong, drank, smoked, and had sex. I pull my jacket round me tighter as the snow drives into my face. I didn't see Ed either. I had been too busy to answer his calls to the surgery. I had told myself he was working hard, so the real Ed was left to drift into danger, unseen. Kate said our mother had never had a clue about us, but I was worse than that. I had seen the clues and ignored them. The white sky has darkened. There are patches of snow on Bertie's coat, but he stands still without shaking them off. There is no one around. The young girl and the man have gone. It's time to go home. When I go in with my heavy bags, there is a tree in the hall entwined with silver-sprayed ivy. Its base is buried in a bucket, wedged in with pebbles from the beach. There are lit candles on the windowsill nearby in little glass holders. Sophie must have brought the spray, the candles, and their holders. Ed has left a note on the kitchen table. Someone called Dan left the tree. Soph decorated it. Gone to pub. E and S. The glow of candles on ivy is silvery soft. I'm still standing there, breathing in the green Christmas tree smell, when a low car glides quietly past the window on the snowy road and turns into the little forecourt. The front door flings open, and Theo is there, taller, broader, tanned. I want to weep with relief. As he bends to hug me hard, He smells different, something bitter and expensive. The warmth dissolves some of the hurt from the morning. He pulls back, turning aside.
Mum, this is Sam.
Sam appears older than Theo by several years, taller, more wiry. He looks different from his photo. Perhaps it's the beard. The brown eyes behind his glasses are watchful.
Hello, Sam.
We embrace, awkwardly. Two kisses, one on each cheek, which always catches me out. He gives me a bunch of flowers with a practiced little bow. Theo chats about the journey, his recent exhibition, what it feels like to be here at the cottage. He has acquired a trace of an American accent. I stand close to him, listening to his voice rather than his words. Then I pull myself together.
You must be starving.
There is the slightest pause.
Not really.
Theo gives me a quick hug.
Don't be cross. We stopped for lunch at the beach hut.
But you were so near home.
We didn't want to trouble you,
Sam answers smoothly. Did he need to get up courage before he met me? Does he want to show his power, that he can hold Theo back from us for as long as he wants? My mind touches these thoughts fleetingly.
Well, you're here now, which is wonderful. You must be tired.
I want to show Sam around.
Which room?
Ed and Sophie are in his old room, but yours is tiny. You could have Dad's and mine.
Don't be silly. We'll manage with mine. I don't take up much space.
I sense Sam's eyes on mine, gauging my reaction.
Fine by me.
Thanks, Mom.
Where is Ed?
Gone to the pub with Sophie.
Sophie? Gosh, all these changes.
Good changes, said Sam.
Bertie appears, disturbed from his sleep by our voices, and runs to Theo, his tail wagging furiously.
Is this Bertie?
Sam sounds surprised. He's older than I thought.
Bertie!
Theo kneels to hug Bertie. He looks up at Sam.
He's not old! How dare you!
He is old, though. Theo noticed it too.
When's Dad home?
I slip the mobile out of my pocket, glance at it briefly. Still no text from Ted.
Tomorrow.
They go to unpack and then take Bertie with them to look for Ed and Sophie. I put my old blue apron on. There are fish to slice and poach, waiting in the fridge with the gleaming grey shells of prawns. I start to chop celery with onions and garlic, then turn on the radio for the carols. The familiar music fills my mind, and the guilt and regret recede a little. There's a knock at the door. I rinse my hands quickly, then walk to open it, my eyes streaming from the onions. It must be Ted, and he's lost his key. I feel slightly sick with anticipation, at the same time annoyed he will see me red-eyed, smelling of onions. I wipe my hands on the apron and open the door. For a moment there is nothing to see in the dark, and then Dan steps forward into the semicircle of light. His face looks thinner than usual, sculptural in the shadow of his hood. There are deep hollows round his eyes. Without thinking, I step forward and kiss him. He flushes darkly.
Thank you for the tree. It's lovely.
I try to cover his embarrassment with my words. Sophie decorated it. She's Ed's friend. They arrived yesterday.
Why are you crying?
He asks abruptly.
I'm not crying. It's the onions. I'm cooking supper. Come in. Have it with us.
No, I... Thanks for the drawing.
He looks at me intently, and then he turns and is gone. Shoulders hunched, sad and angry at the same time. He's escaping the family Christmas and has come looking for something. I feel I have failed him. I stir the onions again, add the fish and stock, saffron, wine. The phone buzzes a message in my pocket. I wash my hands and take it out.
Unable to make Christmas. Hope New Year. T.
Not sorry. No love. No message for Ed or Theo. I had promised myself that I would never again allow him to surprise me with hurt. Unable to make Christmas. If his plane has been cancelled, why not explain? I put my phone down without texting back. Over the last year, I had worked it so that what Ted did wasn't important. And by now, I thought I had made it true. Bristol, 2009. 6 days after. Ted's infidelity wasn't the issue. We would deal with it afterwards when we had time. It wouldn't hurt then. I told myself that I was good at this. I prioritize all the time. Ted phoned from the police station later in the morning.
I told them, he said briefly. It wasn't too complicated after all.
Perhaps they had been complicit at the police station. It's a male thing, infidelity, they might have said to themselves. They probably thought that it didn't really matter. When Ted reappeared in the kitchen, he looked better. There was even a glimmer of pleasedness about him, like a little boy who has done wrong, but discovers he might get away with it. In another life, I could have replayed back to him the practiced excuse of being at the hospital he had given me the night she disappeared. But I already felt we were very far from where I thought we had been then, and there seemed no point. I was curious, though. How come they believed you?
They asked Beth to come in and...
And?
They rang the restaurant where we tried to get a meal. They remembered telling us they were closed.
We. Us. I stood there, the words echoing in my mind as Ted watched me silently. I couldn't let this matter. I wouldn't allow it to get in the way. I've made a list of what we need to do, I said briefly. Ted looked away. It was unimportant, Jenny. I was tired and drunk. A stupid lapse. It couldn't matter less. A lapse. Not a betrayal or a lie. After 20 years, there were layers of how it mattered. But if I let go of where I was, I could get sucked into depths of minding. I don't want to talk about any of it now, I said. We can't just pretend it didn't happen. His eyes looked puzzled. That's exactly what I'm going to do for now. When we find Naomi, we'll deal with this. You don't care if I was unfaithful? He sounded incredulous. What do you want, Ted? A scene?
Well, it would be a natural kind of...
He didn't know how to finish.
I'm not doing it. There isn't time.
Something flickered at the back of his eyes. Disappointment? Triumph? Then he shrugged and spoke quickly.
You're right. We're losing time. What's on the agenda today?
Miss Wenham.
Miss Wenham?
The headmistress. We have an appointment at midday.
Damn. I delayed my clinic to start at midday because I had to go to the police station.
He pulled his mouth down and spread his hands wide. Helpless. Let it go. I can do it.
It doesn't need both of us, I said. I want to see if anyone at school has thought of anything since they saw the police. Then I've made 500 copies of her school photo with information about when she was last seen.
I thought the police had done that. He frowned as if he had missed something. There's one on the lamppost outside. The school must have lots, of course.
It's not for around here, I said. I'm going everywhere in Bristol. Clubs, pubs, railway station, bus station, anywhere there's a space, I'm going to put them up.
I was walking around the room as I spoke, collecting the file of pictures, blue tack, drawing pins, hammer, nails.
I could help this evening. Perhaps I could get off later this afternoon.
I found it difficult to look at him.
Michael will come with me.
What do you think we should say to the boys?
Nothing.
He looked relieved.
Really? They've got enough to deal with. You said it yourself. Nothing important happened.
Ted left, and I had a bath. As I lay in the water, my body soothed by its warmth, unbearable images began to push themselves into my mind. Naomi, dirty, and longing for the comfort of a bath, her torn body crusted with dirt, or worse, covered with it, soil in her ears and mouth. If she was dead, would her eyes be open? Would her mouth? I got quickly out of the bath, toweling myself dry fiercely. Think of something else, anything, anything hopeful. The boys are coping. Jade is getting better. Survive, I told the white face in the mirror. Think of Naomi's smiling face as it was after the play when Ted hugged her.
It wasn't possible that I wouldn't see her again. Survive till then, I whispered, unsure whether I was talking to Naomi or myself. I didn't bother with a coat, though it was a cold, grey, late November day. Outside the front door, a weary-looking man in his 40s pushed himself away from the garden wall, notebook in hand, a careful look of sympathy on his pudgy face. He started taking photos when it was obvious I wouldn't reply to his questions. I turned away and began to hurry down the road. For a while I could hear him puffing after me. The school was only 5 minutes' walk away. She had done this hundreds of times. Had she been watched in the last few weeks? Even as she was making a new relationship, was someone else tracking her, working out the times she came and went, and when she was likely to be on her own? Miss Wenham was in her study. A bulky woman in her 50s, she stood up to greet me. Her appearance never changed. Speech day or sports day, the iron grey hair was always neatly curled. She shook my hand. Dr. Malcolm, I'm so terribly sorry. Such an anxious time. We as a school are doing everything we can to cooperate with the investigation. As we sat down, her glance was searching. Not unkind, just curious. Thanks. I just wanted to see you in case something had occurred to any of the staff, or perhaps... I could see already she had nothing new to tell me, and I felt such overwhelming tiredness that I could hardly finish my sentence. Perhaps one of the children might know something and have told you since the police came, or... It was pointless. She shook her head. The police have been here 3 times now, she went on. However, Mrs. Andrews is Naomi's form teacher. She wanted to talk to you. She gestured towards a chair. A pale young woman I hadn't noticed until then stood up and walked forward to meet me. Hello, Dr. Malcolm. I'm Sally Andrews. Her hair had slipped from a clasp at the side of her head and was falling into her eyes. She took my hand in a weak grip and smiled awkwardly. I'm very sorry for what's happened, she flushed. I've been trying to think since the police came. They said to say if anything out of the ordinary struck us. Last night, it came to me, there had been something different about Naomi. She sat down next to me on the sofa. What do you mean, different? I asked her, more sharply than I meant to. For about 2 months, she was a bit dreamy. I thought she was under the weather, actually, but she said she felt fine. I was silent. Sally Andrews had noticed her pregnancy, though she hadn't realized it. I was no further forward. She was carrying on. I wasn't worried about the dreaminess, really, but she asked me something about leaving school, which struck me as odd at the time. She swallowed. She wanted to know if she could come back and finish her exams if she left early. Early? I thought she must mean if she left after GCSEs. She might have wanted to take a breather then. Some girls do, and then they come back for A-levels afterwards. But last night, I was in my bath when they were talking about Naomi on the radio again. I imagined her slender body floating in the bath, hair in a bath cap, while her husband padded in and out. It came to me then that it was almost as if she'd known she would be leaving before GCSEs next summer. It's just one of those funny coincidences, I expect, but when I heard you were coming today, I thought I must tell you what she'd said. In case... She stopped talking. Her cheeks looked pink. After I had shaken her hand again and thanked both of them, I left. On the way home, I felt like running. Perhaps Naomi had planned this after all. She might have collected money over weeks and worked out what to do about the exams she would be missing. If she had left on purpose, it changed everything. She would be all right. She would come back. When Michael came to collect me, he looked surprised to see me ready in the kitchen, makeup on, and the wad of photocopies in my hand. All set? He asked. I nodded, and we left together. There was no trace of awkwardness as he opened the car door for me. He had obviously put that kiss aside easily. Could it be because he had done it before, and he knew how to behave as if nothing had happened?
I told him what Sally Andrews had said. I could see him carefully judging the significance of her words.
Naomi was pregnant, he said. She was thinking ahead. The baby would have meant time off and possibly missing GCSEs. I expect she wanted to know if she could take the exams later.
The hope I had felt started to drain away.
She doesn't sound like the sort of girl who would cause her parents so much suffering. If this was planned, she would have let you know by now.
He glanced over at me.
Sorry, Jenny.
Would she, though? The streets slid by the car windows, full of people who weren't near me. As I watched them walking along the pavements, alive and unhindered, I realized I hadn't just lost her. Perhaps I had lost her long before she disappeared, and I had no idea who she was anymore.
21. Dorset, 2010. 13 months later. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The joyful morning voices escape through grey stone and stained glass, floating out over lichen-covered graves. Strange how everyone is so glad that Jesus was born when they know how the story ends. Surely they realize that if the girl in the stable had been told what would happen to her baby, she would have been heartbroken. Naomi's birth by caesarean had been so easy compared with the physical anguish of pushing out the boys. It had felt like cheating. She was lifted out and given to me to hold, blood wet and burning against my skin. She had stared calmly into my face, her dark blue eyes serious, as if she recognized me. I didn't want to let her go, but they wrapped her up, and Ted had held her in the hot peace of the delivery room while I was being stitched. They had looked totally absorbed in each other. Bertie sniffs at the church wall and cocks his leg. He trundles off down the bridle path, with his head close to the ground, and I follow slowly. I'd been too sleepy to wait up for the children to come back from the pub yesterday evening, but even after the early night I'm still tired. The path leads us down to the beach. The story in the village is that this little track is an ancient smuggler's way. At night, some say in the village, you can hear the crunch of booted feet on stone and horses whinnying, the echoes of oaths and the rumble of carts bearing caskets of rum. This morning there is only the delicate crack of ice below the snow under our feet. A male pheasant startles up from the hedge with his hollow, rasping cry of alarm. Handel's music fades behind us as I follow Bertie further down the bridle path. We come out onto the shingle. The sea churns with yellow foam. No one else is on the beach. As the sun rises, points of light shift and shine on the water. If I half close my eyes, I can almost make them like the city lights which had seemed more brightly lit on Naomi's first night. The counsellor said to leave some memories as if wrapped in tissue paper, for when I felt strong enough. I feel strong enough now. I remember the city landscape had spread out like a shining canvas in front of me. From where I had stood in front of the window in the hospital, even at midnight it dazzled with light, magical and mysterious. I knew that the roads were thudding with traffic, and there would be vomit on the pavement, pigeon shit and blown rubbish. But from the distance of the fourth floor maternity unit, the streets had looked immaculate and celebratory. In the distance, Clifton Suspension Bridge blazed with lights, like birthday candles in a dark room. Her head was waxy under my lips, her hair like damp feathers. I had sat on a chair near the window, wincing as the catgut stitches dug into tender flesh. Naomi had stirred and whimpered. I had guided her head carefully, pushing in the nipple. As I fed her, I'd felt as connected to her as if she was still inside me. Ted had gone home to sleep. I imagined him face down, head turned to my side of the bed, arm over my pillow. He would be peacefully snoring, and I remember smiling as I cradled her over my shoulder, her warmth reaching into my heart. The snow has started again, Time to go home. I look round, expecting Bertie to be just behind. He's not there. I know he came down onto the beach from the lane. The surf is high and fierce. In a few moments, the waves have become sinister. Where is he? I shout his name over and over, but my voice is whipped away by the wind. I run up the beach, half staggering on the shingle. He might have started up the path back home, and then I catch sight of him, hidden behind a boat. He is lying down, shivering. A wave must have caught him. My arms strain to lift him. He is soaking and awkwardly struggles out of my clasp to stand with his tail wagging. Stupid, stupid dog! I lay my cheek against his silky, wet head. Don't ever do that again! Back in the cottage, everyone is up. The fire is blazing. I breathe in the scent of coffee and batter while I rub Bertie dry with a towel. Sam is wearing my apron, and there is a shiny waffle-making machine on the table with a red bow on top.
"Your present," he says. "I wanted to give you a taste to go with it."
Golden crisp waffles are stacked on the plate. His smile is white-toothed and friendly. The edginess of our meeting yesterday has gone, and I feel I am meeting him properly now. Ed comes in from the sitting room, but he avoids looking at me. He's probably glad I went to bed early. It meant he didn't have to confront me again yesterday. He picks up a waffle and eats it whole. He is thinner than I had realized.
"When's Dad back then?" he asks.
"He sent me a message yesterday. He's not coming after all. He says he's unable to make it. Flight problems, I expect."
"I knew it. I told you he was on holiday."
He sits down. Sam, stirring more waffle mixture, briefly touches his shoulder.
"It's that woman's fault, isn't it?"
Ed stares at me then. "What woman?" I look at him, puzzled. Is he blaming Ted's secretary for cancelled flights?
"Oh, for God's sake, Mum, you don't have to pretend for me. I know."
"Know what?"
"About Beth, of course. They came to see me to say goodbye just before they left for South Africa. I bet it's her decision. She probably wanted to stay on, do a safari or something."
Her name sounds so casual in Ed's voice. "Just once," Ted had said. He'd called it a lapse, and I decided to believe him. The room is quiet. I sense Sam look at me quickly. I struggle to keep my face calm.
"He'd rather be with her, obviously," Ed says briefly.
"It may not be that." I reach for the chair and sit down. "Perhaps he's held up somewhere."
"Stop protecting him," Ed shrugs. "I mean, who cares? Why does it matter, really?"
He's wrong. I'm not protecting Ted. I'm protecting myself. I thought his flight had been cancelled. How stupid. I look round the room. My mind reaches for its touchstones. The boys, Michael, Bertie, my paintings, the cottage, Mary and Dan. Theo comes in and gives me a kiss, then kisses Sam.
"Don't dare kiss me,"
Ed says to his brother, covering his head with both hands.
"Don't worry, I'm not going to touch your louse-ridden head."
Theo reaches over for a waffle. "These look brilliant."
"Dad's not coming," Ed tells him.
"What?"
Theo says indistinctly, his mouth full.
"Enjoying himself in Africa with his girlfriend."
"Girlfriend?" Theo stops eating. "What girlfriend?" He turns to look at me.
"Mum's cool with it," Ed answers. "So who cares?"
"And it does mean,"
Sam balances two more waffles on the pile,
"all the more waffles for us."
He laughs. Thank God for Sam. I love him in that minute. Theo sees me smile and smiles uncertainly. In the moment of silence, Sophie appears, in a red and orange jersey. She looks towards me, checking how I am.
"Happy Christmas," she says.
Sam leads the way into the sitting room, where he stands in front of the roaring fire and opens one of the champagne bottles he brought. The cork hits the ceiling and frothing liquid spills over his sleeve as he tries to pour it into glasses. He gives the first glass to me.
"For courage," he says.
His brown eyes are kind. I smile back at him then and raise my glass.
"Courage."
"Yeah, Mum. You have to be brave to have us lot for Christmas,"
Theo says. brave. They are rescuing me. I look outside quickly. In the garden, someone, Theo, Sophie, has scattered crumbs along the top of the far wall. The birds are little downward-tilted triangles feasting, fluttering up and down, jostling for places. A vivid image comes to mind. Our honeymoon, a tent in the Serengeti, birds flying around us at mealtimes, alighting on our table, fighting for crumbs. Ted holding me. We held each other all the time. Heat and sex and happiness. The smell of hot canvas. My skin prickles. They have been together for a year. Not a one-off lapse after all. They are celebrating in Africa.
Mum, we're waiting to open our presents.
He never stopped seeing her. He lied again and again. Ed, wait for Mum. How stupidly trusting I'd been. The signs had been there, but I had refused to see them, and as I close my eyes, it's as though I am breathing in the faintest scent of lavender.
Look, Mum!
I open my eyes. Theo and Sam have brought in a huge flat parcel from their car, propping it against the wall. Theo fetches the scissors from the kitchen drawer and hands them to me, but he keeps a hand on the parcel.
On second thoughts, Mum, you may want to wait to open this.
Wait? Not a chance.
I have to focus on what's important right now.
The lavender scent fades in the warm smell of the burning apple logs and the pine from the Christmas tree. This will be one of Theo's photos of New York, perhaps, or of Sam. Theo and Sam against the New York skyline. I start to cut the paper.
It's Naomi, Mum.
Theo sounds tense. I pull the rest of the paper off. All the photos are of Naomi. There is a large one in the middle, taken by the school for West Side Story. She must have been pregnant then. Her skin is luminous. There are at least 100 other photos of her, different shapes and sizes. I take in 3-year-old Naomi, piggyback with Ted, 5 years old with an uneven fringe that she had cut herself. At 10 with braces, waving from the branches of our tree. At 12 with a hockey stick, and Nikita laughing.
Theo,
I can't continue.
I'm sorry, Mum.
He looks stricken. Sam says in an undertone, I warned you. Let's take it away. He stoops to lift the heavy frame.
Wait! It's wonderful. Don't take it away. Leave it here by the wall.
I point to the space.
I'll hang it, just by Grandpa's chair. That way I'll see it every day when I sit here. I'll be able to take it in bit by bit.
I found all these pictures when I went to clear out the loft with Dad. Theo looks happier now.
I've wanted to give them to you before, but I thought it would be better to wait. I probably shouldn't have given them to you yet.
It's a perfect present. Ed puts more wood on the fire. Sam has insisted on cooking Christmas dinner. He brought cornbread from America and somewhere found cranberries and stuffing. Theo and Sophie vanish into the kitchen as well. They don't allow me in.
We want you to rest.
Sophie smiles shyly and shuts the door. Ed is lying by the fire, his head propped on an elbow, reading one of his new books. His body is relaxed, as if he said what he needed to say yesterday. I watch his eyes scanning back and forth. Maybe one day he will see that it wasn't easy, and maybe that's as much as I can hope for. There is quiet knocking at the door. Ed gets up and goes into the hall. There is a little pause, then,
Hey, your tree looks great. Want to see it?
No, I just wanted to say my gran says the wood has run out. Could we borrow?
Dan's voice, hesitant. Hopeful. The kitchen door opens. From where I sit, I see Sam come out and put a glass of champagne in Dan's hand.
You can't visit at Christmas without coming in for a drink, he says warmly.
Dan comes in, slips his shoes off. He glances towards me, questioning. I smile and raise my glass. He is wearing his hoodie again, and his jeans have slipped down on his hips. He looks cold, as if he's been outside for a while.
Dan disappears with him into the kitchen. In a while, I see Theo in the garden loading the wheelbarrow with wood and then pushing it out through the side gate to the lane for Mary. She'll realize Dan is escaping the family meal, and she'll make his excuses. There is almost no room in the kitchen when we're all gathered. On the table, holly and ivy strands weave between candles. Sophie has fed Bertie, and he sits at her feet. Sam puts a steaming plate with crumbling slices of turkey, stuffing, and gravy in front of Dan, who looks awkward.
I didn't...
Theo cuts in.
We've wanted to meet you. Mum told us how you used the branches of the old apple tree. I took some photos of my sister once, and the branches around her were like the ones Mum said you used for your wood sculptures.
Sister. My sister. I haven't heard those words in months. They make it sound as though she's still here. Ed looks at me. One arm is round Sophie, and he raises his glass. He looks at me. His eyes are guarded, but not like they were before. Bristol, 2009. 8 days after. Ed's eyes frightened me. I had woken that morning into the realization that it had been a week and a day since Naomi had gone. Some momentum should have gathered. Instead, everything seemed to have slowed down. I was simply waiting. Worse, I was pinned down, immobilized by fear. Enough! I said it out into the silence as I kicked the duvet off. Enough! Today would be different. Ted had gone to work already. Theo had left early too. There was a note on the table to say he'd gone to assemble the materials for his scholarship exam. He had applied for a photography course at the New York Film Academy the following year. The scholarship could be decisive, but I'd forgotten it was today. Normally, I'd have sent him off with a good breakfast. We would have discussed timing and techniques, and I would have said good luck. Guilt reached deeply inside. I was letting everything go. Ed came down as I was making coffee. He sat at the table, and as I passed him, I caught the stale smell again. So, Friday, I said as I tried to remember his routine. Rowing practice? Anya told me his kit had been on his bathroom floor, soaking wet for days. He put two hands against the table and pushed his chair out so hard and quickly that I had to sidestep. He looked at me as he got up, and that was when I noticed the fury in his eyes. I'm not a fucking child, he said, just before he shut the door. Anya came in quietly. She had brought a little pale pink cyclamen plant, put it in a pot on the table and nodded to me. I knew it was supposed to cheer me up. For a moment, my attention was caught by the creamy petals with their sharp-edged frill. Flowers went with illness and death and graves, but these were pink, like the ones I had carried at my wedding. Thank you, Anya. They're lovely. She smiled as she began clearing the table. Anyone else's presence would have been an intrusion, but her careful movements were balm. Without her, the house would have descended into dirty chaos by now. Ed was suffering like we all were. It was worse for him. No matter how often we told him, it wasn't his fault. I knew he felt guilty. I found an A3-sized white cardboard sheet wedged behind my desk. Theo had bought more than he needed for his woodland project. I wrote Naomi in the middle, in blue felt tip, and drew a series of concentric circles in increasing size around her name, the first for family, the second for school. I wrote Nikita's name here, and ticked it because she had been seen by the police. James, another tick. Teachers, Sally Andrews, Miss Wenham, tick, tick, tick. What about other teachers? Mrs. Mears, the drama teacher who had resigned. I needed to ask Michael. I drew a further ring for people she saw often but not every day. Anya? Anya's husband. I looked at her quietly brushing the floor. She sensed me watching her and smiled. I put a question mark next to Anya's husband to remind me to check with Michael if he had been questioned by the police. Neighbours belonged in this circle too. Mrs. Moore opposite. Harold, her son, that shadowy figure at the window. Michael must have checked him too, but I put a question mark against his name in case. What else? The play? Anyone who'd worked in the theatre? Reception staff? Had Michael checked? There was a sudden exclamation of pain. The broom clattered to the floor.
You okay, Anya?
I stub my toe. Your doctor's bag. I don't see it there. New place.
Sorry. Shove it back under the bench. Someone must have kicked it out by mistake. Doctor's bag. Work. Another circle. Colleagues and patients. If I were to go back, something might jog my memory. Frank had said to be off for the duration, but it already felt too long. I wanted to do something. Even making this chart was doing something. I showed the paper to Michael when he called in around midday. I wondered what it was like to come into this house, and whether you could smell grief at the doorway. He took off his jacket and rolled up his sleeves. His arms looked strong. Something about his calm face and the focus of his grey eyes made me think of soldiers before a battle.
He whistled in admiration. That's like a professional inquiry layout. What about all the question marks?
As I handed him a cup of coffee, I wanted to laugh.
The whole thing is one great question mark.
He bent closer over my chart.
Some questions have been answered, so we can cross them off right now. Like the school, he said.
Mrs. Mears?
Yes, her alibi checked out. She had exemplary references and records, like all the teachers in the whole school.
What about all the other staff?
Done. All the ancillary workers, gardeners, cleaners, cooks and caretakers. The receptionist and bar staff at the school theatre. They've all been questioned and their alibis checked.
He'd been busy. That was good, of course, but my heart sank. I had thought I was being useful, doing something that might get us closer to her. In reality, I was trailing behind.
Okay, then there's my work, I said. Should we look there?
We've interviewed your colleagues. They talked about Jeff Price as well, but he was in the hospital with Jade, like you said.
I lowered my voice. Anya's husband?
Interviewed. Alibi checked. You gave us a lot of this information on the first night.
My optimism was leaking away. What had happened to my memory? All I could remember was asking the police to find her, begging and crying. I looked at my board again.
What about the neighbours?
Finished yesterday, with Mrs. Moore, he said.
What did Harold say?
He wasn't there.
Michael sipped his coffee.
She told me not to bother going back. Apparently he can't communicate well.
He never goes out, and I'm sure he can communicate. She's protecting him. I pictured the small woman, her back to the closed door of the room where she had hidden her son. I leant forward urgently. He's always looking out of the window. He might have seen something.
Then we need to see if he can tell us anything.
Michael stood.
Do you want to come? He asked. It could be useful, but if I have to question him in depth, you may need to leave.
I took several copies of Naomi's photograph off the pile stacked next to my computer. As we crossed the road, Michael paused and walked to the white van parked close to our house. Opening the door, his voice became raised, though I couldn't make out the words. He needn't have bothered. I didn't mind about the journalists. They hardly figured in the roaring terror that filled every moment. Ted hated them. Mrs. Moore answered the door after a few minutes. She was wearing an apron tied tightly round her waist. Her face hardened when she saw both of us.
Said my bit already,
she nodded accusingly at Michael.
Told him yesterday.
And Harold, I tried to speak gently. He could be helpful, Mrs. Moore. He watches out of the window. You can easily see the theatre from here.
He's having his dinner. If we could just have a word,
Michael said quietly. It needn't take long. Inside the dark hall, there was a mirror glinting in the gloom. Mrs. Moore led us into a large, immaculately tidy kitchen. Harold wasn't eating. He was drawing. A plate with a half-eaten sandwich was pushed aside. He was wearing a striped short-sleeved shirt, tightly stretched over his curved back. His bare arms were plump and scattered with moles. He was breathing heavily, his tongue protruding as he worked. A box of crayons was tipped on the table, next to a stack of drawings. They were all smudged with blue wax. Michael picked up a drawing, and Harold snatched it back. I knelt by Harold's chair and showed him the photocopied picture.
This is a picture of Naomi, Harold. You know Naomi?
Close up, his face was completely smooth. No smile or frown lines.
Gone, he said.
Ah,
Michael turned to Mrs. Moore.
He knows that from the TV, she said grimly. Andy heard you talking yesterday. I didn't want him involved. I told him to stay quiet in the other room when you came last time. He doesn't know anything.
Is that right, Harold?
Michael asked him lightly.
Or is there anything at all you can tell us?
Harold stared at him blankly. He started scribbling hard with the blue crayons. I stood up, and we waited for a moment looking down at him, reluctant to leave.
Well, if you remember anything, please let us know, Michael said.
Outside, the white van had gone. Michael smiled grimly. Back in my kitchen, he made some notes while I phoned Frank, relieved to hear the answering machine. It meant not having to answer questions about how I was. Instead, I left a brief message. They might need help. Midwinter was always busy in the surgery. I was still by the phone when there was a loud knock. Michael, gathering his things to leave, went to answer. Harold was standing outside, a wad of paper under his arm.
Naomi,
he said loudly.
Naomi!
Mrs. Moore appeared breathlessly at his shoulder. Harold wouldn't wait. It turns out he's got something to tell you after all that. Harold put his pictures on the table. There were about 20 in smeared blue wax. They all had a squarish shape, with an oblong protruding from one side. He pointed to the shape.
Truck,
he said. Michael sifted through the pile and drew out one where the blue shape was in front of an outlined square.
That's the theatre, said Mrs. Moore. After you left, you started on about your daughter.
A blue truck outside the theatre? I thought back desperately. Had I seen a blue truck, or even a blue car, ever? Maybe there had been one, streaked with mud, a small dog with his nose to the sliver of open window at the back. Or had it been a big, dark blue Mercedes? Either could be true, or made up completely, conjured out of suggestion. Harold had a screwed-up piece of paper in his hand. He was pushing it into the picture of the blue truck. There was sweat along his upper lip. The razor had missed little clumps of hair by his right ear, and another in the cleft of his chin. He was getting angry.
Thank you, Harold, Michael said quietly. It's kind of you to help us find Naomi.
Harold stared at him. Michael eased the screwed-up paper from his grip and flattened it on the table. It was the photocopied picture of Naomi.
Thank you, Michael said again. That was very helpful. You have been more helpful than anyone else.
After they had gone, I glanced at Michael. This could be important.
Maybe, he replied.
He inspected the picture again.
That rectangular shape, joined to the square one, makes it more like a pickup van.
Turning to me, concern flitted over his face. I knew what he was seeing. My exhausted face, lank hair, red eyes, the new thinness.
You look...
Don't tell me I look terrible. It doesn't matter a fuck. A shocked expression crossed his face and I laughed, actually laughed.
If you knew how much I don't care about my appearance.
The boys will, Michael said steadily. Ted will. Your appearance is part of how you stay strong.
I knew that made sense, but it was almost impossible to think about my own appearance when my mind was full of Naomi, how she had looked when I last saw her, how she might be looking now. I touched Michael's arm.
Do you think it will help, this blue van?
It might. He smiled down at me. There are a lot of blue vans about, but it's one more tiny bit of information, one more thread. This is how it's done, you see. We untangle the threads one at a time.
When Theo came home, he looked miserable. He thought he'd done badly in the art scholarship. He had changed his mind too often and ended up rushing. We had supper together. Ed came in a while afterwards. He had been coming in later and later recently, often working in the library until it closed. He didn't want food. He had eaten at school. Sometime after supper, I caught sight of Theo lying on his bed, talking on his mobile. He grinned at me more cheerfully. Ed had left his door open. He had fallen asleep on his bed with all his clothes on. I slipped his shoes off and covered him with a blanket. As I turned to go, the light from the landing caught a pile of notes on his bedside table. I looked closely. There were 10- and 20-pound notes, stacked in a neat pile, maybe £300 in all. What was he doing with this money? Where did it come from? Ted transferred the boy's allowance from his account online, so it was unlikely to be from him. Had Ed been working in secret somewhere? Perhaps all the evenings I thought he was studying at school, he was working for money at a pub. Why hadn't he told us? Was he saving it to give to us, trying to make amends for not being there for Naomi in the theatre? The thought caught at my heart. I wanted to wake him up and ask him, but even in sleep he looked exhausted. It would have to wait till morning. I tiptoed out and closed the door. 22. Dorset, 2010. 13 months later. The air in the shed smells stale after Christmas. Mouse droppings are scattered on the sheet of paper I left on the table, and the wax crayons have been etched with tiny teeth marks. My feet crunch on grit blown through the gap under the door. I shut the door again and go back into the house. In the mornings, when the light is still grey, I wander around the house in this nothing time between Christmas and New Year. I can tell exactly where I am with my eyes closed. The air feels differently charged around the blue chair, the silky wood of the desk, the pile of books. Touching the familiar furniture is like touching my own skin. I look at the photos from Theo's montage one at a time. Today it's the baby in the pram, her eyes serious, looking at the patterns the cherry tree blossoms made against the sky. The picture captures a starfish hand reaching to touch the shadow of the leaves on the inside of her pram. I miss the boys and Michael. He had tactfully arranged a cover at work when we thought Ted might be here at Christmas, though he knows we have separated. He calls every night, never in the day. Our relationship is still secret from his colleagues. I don't know what would happen if they found out. I miss him. My body misses his. I find myself craving him unexpectedly. In my darker, mistrustful moments, I wonder if he knows this, if he wants to gain some kind of hold by his absence. Could he be playing a game? He has stepped across a boundary to make love. Should that make me trust his motives more or less? Ed has gone back to the unit. He's planning to stay for a few more months, but he didn't talk about detailed plans. He didn't talk to me about his feelings again either, though Sophie gave me a hug as they left. His words echo on, and I turn them over and over until I feel as if I'll go mad. Did I trade Naomi's life for mine? Now that I have all the space and time I ever wanted, I'd swap everything for a second of her. Theo phones. It's so good to be back home. Ridiculous to feel a pang. Think I could live here forever. As he talks, I hear the clink of bottles and Sam's voice singing Carmen in the background. Once Theo's relationship with Sam would have taken us time to encompass, causing a shift in the smooth track of our lives and the assumptions we made. Instead, it has found its place easily. After Theo's call, I try the shed again, shaking the little battered tin tubes of oil paints out of their box into a small heap on the trestle table. French ultramarine, Indian red, Naples yellow, a whole geography of colours. Theo said forever. That's as far as you can see before you've been hurt. Though of course he has been hurt. No, it's further than that. It's as far as you can imagine, stretching to all the places and people that you think will always be there. But nothing lasts. Not places, not people, not love, nor the vanishing lives of children. Loss does. And I start to make thick, straight lines with Sophie's charcoal. At the beginning, I didn't see how I could ever manage the hours, then the days, the weeks, the months of forever, the dull metal of her absence never wearing any thinner. As I work, dark crumbs break from the sticks, and I blow them away. The boys don't talk much about Naomi. The space behind them is full of her, but their lives have gone beyond hers. Mine hasn't. I've endured, that's all. I cross the vertical lines with horizontal bars to make a grid, thinking about the colours to put between the lines, luminescent, bordered by darkness, but not stained by it. These spaces will represent the boys' lives. I walk in tight circles inside the shed, trying to think of a colour for them, one that sounds a clear note, but carries other darker ones within it. It's difficult to think of a pigment that holds light and shadow at the same time. Perhaps a glowing cinnabar orange. I need more colours. I imagine some kind of rich desert dust that has been distilled by wind and heat. Then I remember the Byzantine paintings hidden in the caves of Geremma in Cappadocia. The frescoes on the walls looked backlit by sun even in the deepest caves. They had a rich, hopeful glow that was also sombre. I experiment with strokes of oil paint on my easel. Cadmium yellow, cadmium pale. Something extra is missing. White? Red? Orange? I lay my brush aside to wait until I can catch it somewhere else. The sunset, or the yolk of an egg, perhaps. As I turn to go, my fingers knock a little bunch of kindling off the bench. I must have paused to look at a painting on the way to make up a fire and left it by mistake. I pick it up, pull out a long twig, and twirl it in my fingers. The wood is grey-brown. There are tiny bumps where next year's leaf buds would have formed. The bark is minutely pitted and delicately peeling in places. The stubbed end is split and frayed as if chewed. The ends open and spread like the thinnest fingers. I sketch the twig roughly, then again, more carefully, larger, then larger still. Forms and shapes, waiting to change into something else. The idea for a large painting begins to form, a cycle of life, a triptych. An unfamiliar excitement starts to build, so light and distant, I'm afraid I will spoil it by thinking about it. I focus on the minute buds, smooth, unformed. After an hour, my hands start shaking with cold, and I have to stop drawing. Back inside the cottage, the excitement is gone. In the empty rooms, the dark condenses around me, the familiar weight of sadness so heavy that I can't move. When the bell goes, I can barely walk to the door. Dan is on the doorstep, serious-eyed, hunched in his coat. "Don't stand there!" I step outside, putting my hand on his sleeve. "Come in! I was hoping someone would call, and here you are!" He walks in past me, looking downwards, suddenly shy. "It's good to see you," I tell him, taking his anorak. "It's been too quiet since Christmas." "You okay?" He looks hard at me, the green flecky eyes searching my face. "Yes, course I am." My smile falters under his gaze. "Well, maybe not okay, exactly." I expect he knows about Naomi from Mary, though I've never told her. As he stands there, he seems to be waiting for more, and some of my resolve breaks. Maybe it's the time of year, but it's the second Christmas without my daughter. So, It's like she's getting further away all the time. I'm wondering what it will be like on the third and then the fourth.
He flushes. I could stay if you like. Would you like me to stay?
Have you had supper?
Well, no, but...
Stay then. Turkey curry? You can carve the meat off if you want to be helpful. He comes in, sits at the table. I give him a glass of wine. He takes off his jersey and rolls up his sleeves as I get the huge carcass from the fridge. Even though it's winter, his arms are brown from working in Mary's garden. Nice tan. As I reach into the cupboard for spices and curry paste, I catch his slow blush. Ed used to be easily embarrassed like this. I should know better. How's the deciding going? He carves carefully, the meat falling in curls on the board.
I'm thinking of going away for a bit.
I glance at him, surprised. Yeah? He looks down.
I saved some money. Theo told me about this art course in New York, cheaper than here even. I've applied for the sculpture modules.
That's great, Dan. Where will you stay?
Sam said I could stay on a mattress with them.
That's fantastic. Do it. I fill up his glass again and clink mine against it. How did you make up your mind in the end? The rice bubbles. I tip the turkey he has carved into the simmering sauce. The kitchen feels warm and like home again, as though Theo or Ed was here. Over food, he talks about his family. How his mother is fine with his plans, and his father, uncertain at first, has now agreed to help him with the fees. He wants to know what I'm doing. His face lights up when I describe the grid painting.